into this life. Could have been born anywhere, but for some reason you just feel like you should be someplace peaceful. A lot of us feel that way. Well, it may very well be that you were a monk or a nun in some part of your life. Or you might come into this life and you just feel a kind of restlessness. Don't know where it comes from. It may be that in another life you were an explorer. And so what happens when you expand your multidimensional perception, you can go into meditation and say, okay, I feel this restlessness. Where is it coming from? You don't ever have to really know, but what happens is the awareness connects, and the part of you that was an explorer can deliver to you a message of what it learned in its life that can satisfy your discontent in this life. And so that's all part of what is possible when you begin to open into that multi-dimensional vibrational awareness.
Multi-dimensional vibrational awareness. So it's a beautiful reality that we're a part of, that we are functioning within. And we're really living at a time when it's become very easy and necessary, actually, to begin to integrate the multidimensional truth of who we are. So when I say integrate, I don't necessarily mean, you know, merging the actual beingness from different realities, except in the level of awareness.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. If you missed any of Health Action, you can hear all of it in its entirety in about 5 or 10 minutes by going to WBAI.org. And that is true of all the shows on WBAI. If you come in the middle, go to the website afterwards and you can hear the whole thing, or at your leisure. Coming up next is Jim Freund's Hour of the Wolf with substitute host Ken Gale. So stay tuned. We'll be talking about the Green Book, which was published from 1936 to 1967 and helped black families find places during Jim Crow that they could get gas or eat in. And we'll be talking about Charles Schulz's work besides Peanuts. We'll be talking about Captain Billy's Whiz Bang and a Diane Duane graphic novel. And so there's a lot to talk about, and I'll be interviewing Nat Gertler.
I wanna be a comic book killer. Bless my muscles on the beach.
And those were the Tearjerkers with Comic Book Hero. I'm Ken Gale, and this is the Nuff Said version of Jim Freund's Hour of the Wolf. Jim will be back next week, and I'm subbing for him, and bring an interview with Nat Gertler and some fascinating books that he publishes. First, a couple of announcements. One is the East Coast Comic Con is going to be April 27 to April 29, Friday to Sunday, in Secaucus, New Jersey. So 355 Plaza Drive, Secaucus, New Jersey. So that we're not talking about the Javits Center car show type of Comic Con. We're talking about a comic book convention. East Coast Comic Con, April 27 to April 29. And the next New York Review of Science Fiction Reading, produced by Jim Freund, is next Tuesday, April 3rd, at the Brooklyn Commons Cafe, 388 Atlantic Avenue, starting at 7 p.m. The readers are novelist Chandler Klang Smith and prose and comic book writer Chris Claremont. Admission is free, though we request donations for the series. We hope to end by 9 p.m. so we can all race home to watch season 2 premiere of Chris's TV show, Legion. If you're a regular Nuff Said listener, you certainly know who Chris Claremont is. He's probably best known for writing the X-Men, and for years was considered the best writer in comics. And he's been written quite a few novels, and he'll be reading from one of them next Tuesday. And my guest is Nat Gertler, who writes comics, he draws comics, and he publishes comics, and he publishes a lot of other stuff. So welcome to WBAI, Nat.
Glad to be here.
I suppose since I am subbing for a science fiction show, we should start by talking about the graphic novel by Diane Duane that you published.
The Misadventures of Prince Ivan. What we did there was collect. She'd done a serial for Eclipse Comics back in the 1980s. She wrote it, and a woman by the name of Sherlock had drawn the whole thing. And that had been lying around, never collected. And I'm sitting there thinking, this is very entertaining. It's sort of more folk tales, a humorous take on folk tales, maybe a pre-Shrek Shrek, really. So I always really enjoyed it. So it was lying around, and I said, I'd like to collect that. It may not be quite enough for a book, so I contacted Diane, contacted Sherlock, got them to do a new backup story, and issued that a number of years ago, and that's still available.
And I'm a huge Diane Duane fan, and I hope every regular listener of Hour of the Wolf is as well. She's probably best known either for her So You Want to Be a Wizard series or for writing Star Trek TV shows, Star Trek comic books, and Star Trek novels, but a tremendous writer. And if she ever shows up at a convention near you, go see her. She is a wonderful speaker as well.
Mm-hmm. And she's got a great range. This humor stuff, I mean, obviously she'd be a sense of humor to a lot of her stuff, but this pure humor folktale take may be a surprise for some of her readers.
Spock's World is very strong science. She really runs the gamut. And So You Want to Be a Wizard is a bunch of kids studying to be magicians before Harry Potter. They didn't go to a special school. They did this after school in their spare time, but had adventures as they learned magic. If Diane Duane is not familiar to you, look it up. And The Misadventures of Prince Ivan, she's sort of satirizing fairy tales and yet using the fairy tale medium to tell actually a wonderful story about a prince and his three sisters.
Mm-hmm.
The artwork is very busy. It reminds me of the underground comics of the early 70s.
Sherlock was definitely willing to throw things in, and it's a very cartoony sensibility going on there, so it works pretty well. And that was really an example of one of the things I like to do is stuff that was lying around anyway, and people may have not, it was never in a book, people have forgotten it exists, but it's Diane Duane. There's no reason there wasn't a book of this.
That's for sure.
New York Times bestselling author did a whole graphic novel's worth of material. It should be available. It shouldn't be just sitting there in back issue boxes where you have to buy, you know, a half dozen or so issues of The Dreamery in order to get it. It should be where some new reader can find it.
Yeah.
So that's just something I'm glad to do.
Although back issues of The Dreamery are worth getting, in bargain bins and wonderful reads, even the stuff that's not by Diane.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I've reprinted some of the stuff that's not by Diane.
Uh-huh.
Leela Dowling illustrated a great adaptation of Alice in Wonderland.
Yes, she did.
I'm sitting there going, here's a great adaptation of Alice in Wonderland. That's a very mainstreamy book. There's no reason that it's not between two covers. So I also issued that.
Yeah, and her version was just wonderful.
Well, Leela's just a very playful,
yes.
playful artist. And... The Dreamery had a sister magazine called Fusion. It was more of a science fiction series that Leela did a lot of the art for. And the first storyline was written by Stephen Barnes, who's a very respected science fiction author. And that was material that, again, had never been collected into a book. And, you know, Phil Foglio did some. There's a lot of good people on it. And so I collected that into a series of books. And so the Complete Fusion is also available from About Comics.
Good for you. How do you keep this stuff in print for such a long time?
Well, at this point, most of what I do is print on demand.
Mm-hmm.
So it stays in print forever because I'm not sitting on a warehouse full of them anymore. When I started out, I was a straight common comics publisher doing comics and book materials. And going through Diamond Distribution to reach the comic shops and to reach bookstores through the Diamond's book distribution arm. And I did a lot of this stuff that way, and I made some profit that way. But after a while, it became clear to me that I had to grow or shrink a bit
mm-hmm.
in order to really keep going. And yeah, I'm a very risk-averse kind of guy. I mean, I looked at doing some big stuff. I looked at getting the comic book rights to adapt The Princess Bride, which would have been a great comic, and I had a great artist lined up, but I eventually said, that's a big financial risk. I'm going to go the other way. And so I switched to print on demand, and I can be free to put out something without worrying whether it's going to make a lot of money, because it's not going to lose me a lot of money. And that really freed me up to put out a lot of other things. So because of that, I can put out something like the Fusion Collections, and I can put them out even if there's no immediate demand for them. I'm not stuck with a warehouse full of them, and the moment I can find a way to point people to it and say, hey, Fusion's out there, you should go buy that,
right.
I can. So the traditional comic book distribution market is really weird, and it's true of actually a lot of the book market, but it's especially true for comic books, that you have to go and get people interested in demanding the book before it exists, before they can see it. You have to have them going to comic book shops and telling them, in 3 months, I want this book, because that's the only way the retailers will order it. And then you have to re-energize your entire potential readership 3 months later to go pick it up when it comes out
right.
so that the retailer will reorder it. And if you're not constantly doing that, then it just disappears entirely. But I can do a book now, come up with a book, get it ready, make it available, and then at any given opportunity, I can start promoting it. And when I promote it, I can send people directly to buy it. You know, it's available for immediate sale. I don't need to turn them into my sales force, convincing retailers to carry it. It's available.
And it's, I really want to emphasize what you said about worrying about losing money on publishing, because for independent publishers, that's a real consideration. I've been one myself, so it's out there.
Oh, yeah. And, you sit there and you have to print up all the books you think you're going to sell over the next few years all up front. And if you guess too many, you're left with a pile of books that you're actually paying for warehouse space to hold. And I went through the painful thing of actually having to pay somebody to destroy piles of books after my warehouse, the warehouse I was using was closing. And I either pay for them there or pay for them to be destroyed or pay for them to be shipped somewhere else where they would just be take up warehouse space for years.
Wow.
And believe me, paying to destroy books is not anywhere in my soul. that combines two things I don't like, spending money and destroying the destruction of books. So print on demand is much happier.
Right.
And because of that, I've been loosened up to put out a lot more material.
And so now let's go to something a lot heavier, which is the Green Book.
The Green Book. The Green Book is an excellent example of that. The Green Book was a travel guide for African Americans during the middle of the 20th century. It was started in 1936, and basically it's mostly a listing of places like hotels and restaurants that would accept African-American customers. Now, this was the Jim Crow era. There was a lot of places out there, mm-hmm. Whether posted or not, that would not serve. You know, somehow the money of black people wasn't green enough for them, and it would not be accepted. Sometimes it was a legal limitation. Sometimes it wasn't. Sometimes it was just a social limitation. But if you wanted to make a long-distance trip in this country and your skin happened to be black, it took a lot of planning to figure out where you could stay. And this book at least made it possible. And this was something they started publishing in 1936 and ran up until the mid-60s.
67.
When, you know, the passage of the Civil Rights Act not totally eliminated the need for it, but it, at least on the surface seemed to eliminate the need for it. And it's a very telling thing. And, you know, so I've been hearing about this. Various people have been writing about the Green Book, and I always wanted to see one myself. And so I went to see, hey, I'll buy a used copy. And then I discovered used copies of this go for thousands and thousands of dollars.
Wow.
And I was like, well, this is something I want. It sounds like other people want it, and it's not available. And from my business head said, well, that's an opportunity. My social caring said, this is an educational thing. This is something that should be out there, should be available. So that all came together, and I started reprinting them. And so far, I've reprinted five different volumes, ranging from 1940 to 1963. And it's met with very good response.
And there is a museum exhibit about the Green Book going on in New York City right now.
Museum of Arts and Design?
Yes, MAD, yes. And it's at
it's
at the south end of Columbus Circle. It used to be a tourist building. It used to be an office building. It used to be a museum back in the 70s. I remember as a kid going to an exhibit on comic strips, on the history of the comic strip, in that same museum. The first time I ever saw comics in a museum. But it hasn't been the same thing all these years, but it's a museum again. And there's this amazing exhibit about the Green Book. They have a film about it that's running constantly. They have a whole wall of books having to do with the Green Book or Jim Crow that you can just read. And included on that shelf are three different editions of the Green Book. There's also an exhibit, an artist who sort of did art inspired by the Green Book and Jim Crow, and in the same museum. And now that exhibit is only going to be around a few more days. So if you're listening,
I think they're doing the Green Book exhibit into July at least.
I was talking to a young lady who works there about the Green Book and about BAI. She's familiar with the station. And mm-hmm. she said, if you're going to mention this on the air, tell them they have to come here by the end of the month.
Okay, well, maybe part of it's going. I don't know. They told me they're going to keep ordering copies of the book for my reprints of it for the gift shop there because it's been doing fairly well for them.
That's a little different, yeah. There's also an exhibit on a couple dozen different artists who did artwork inspired by the wall between the U.S. and Mexico. And
The border wall.
Yeah. There's a book.
Did they get Mexico to pay for that exhibit?
There's a booklet.
No.
There's a booklet that goes with the exhibit and where the artists are describing what went through their mind as they did the artwork. And I found the booklet much more interesting than the artwork itself. but then I'm a reader and I'm a print junkie and whatever. I really do want to I mentioned this on Facebook, and I mentioned the whole show on Facebook, and Sydney Smith, who used to be a producer here, not only shared the notice about tonight's show, but I asked him to give me some memories of the Green Book, because he's old enough to remember it. And he said, well, we had a flat tire while on the road, this in Maryland, the border of legal Jim Crow. The Green Book listed that both Gulf and Flying Horse stations in most of that state was safe for Negroes. So Dad called one of the mobile Flying Horse stations listed in the Green Book that was near us from a roadside phone. Yeah, they had those all over the place back then. We waited a few hours, but they came, towed us in, engine trouble too. I remember that the people were very nice. I was 8 or 9 then. The Green Book, I'm sure, saved lives. I have no doubt of that.
Absolutely.
It listed safe camping, picnicking places, motels, parking areas, movie houses. And by the way, no drive-in movies. None. There were no places for colors in any of them. In fact, in my life, I've never been to one. As for traveling, I never thought about that at all.
Yeah, neither I.
As for traveling, I remember watching as my folks would go over the pages of the Green Book when planning trips. This so we'd always be near places we could use. Basically, all that everyone else took for granted, but could be life-threatening to coloreds if they went to the wrong places of that era. And it mentioned either on the exhibit or in the Green Book about Esso. Esso is the old name for Exxon. And there's a lot of Esso stations in the Green Book, and a lot of Esso stations were friendly to African Americans. And it turns out that the Esso company would even allow black people to franchise their service stations.
Yeah, and that wasn't common. And
I
some
think,
of the Esso stations would sell the Green Book because they were actually cultivating that,
right,
that market.
And I think the museum had a caption saying that Esso was the only oil company in America that would allow black people to franchise their business. And he said, Sydney Smith, mm-hmm, again, not all Esso stations were safe outside of cities. Let's say they were somewhat safer than most. Mobile Flying Horse was always better for us on the road. I imagine it was a corporate decision thing early on. For the others, it was mostly the attitude of whoever was running the individual stations. Esso, as it happened, just had more reasonable folks in their trade. And the exhibit also mentioned that people, because there were hundreds of miles that you could travel, where there was not a single bathroom that you could use, they actually invented portable johns for people to carry in their cars.
Oh, yeah. And sometimes, if you look at the 1940 Green Book, for example, and you go to New Mexico, everything's listed by state.
Right.
New Mexico, there's one line in there. There is one place to stay, and that place was somebody's house. That's what they call a tourist home. It's sort of the 1940 equivalent of Airbnb.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't a hotel or anything. It was somebody who was willing to put you up in a room in their house. So, and that's for an entire state. Now, it's possible there were other places that you could stay in a state, but you had no way of knowing it.
Right. And being a baseball history buff, I've read a lot about black ball plays, both in the Negro Leagues and the Major Leagues. And they would be playing in a city where there was not a single hotel or motel they could stay in. But they stayed in people's homes.
One of my inspirations towards reprinting something like this, just so people know, I am not an African American myself, but my stepmother is a very dear woman. She's half Native American, half Cherokee, half African American, and she would tell me stories of when she was young and she was with her high school. I think it was their track team. And they would be taking a trip to do a competition in some foreign city, some city outside the local area.
Right.
And they would have to leave her out at some hotel outside of town while everybody else, who was white, would go on the bus and actually stay in the city where they were competing. Because there was no place within the city limits that would be willing to take her.
And it's amazing to think of, you know, some family putting up Hank Aaron or Willie Mays because there was no hotel they can use. And I mean, I wonder what it's like for, you know, the kids who were in that family going, you know, Hank Aaron stayed at my house. And like, and I'm sure their friends are like, yeah, right. But that's how it had to be. And I forgot what team it was, that it was owned by a guy who owned a chain of hotels. And his own players could not stay at his hotels during spring training. And it was, I mean, it's really an eye-opener for, you know, an ordinary white person. I don't know how ordinary I am, to read about black ball players. You know, it's one thing to be a fan of them, you know, on the field, and it's another to read about their lives. And
yeah,
so,
the things they had to go through just to provide that bit of sports entertainment.
And I never read about the Green Book while reading anything or hearing an interview with Hank Aaron or Willie Mays. And I kind of wonder that they if they had to use the Green Book or if they had somebody on the team doing that for them.
Yeah, somebody who was navigating that. I wouldn't be surprised either way.
Because I know that Negro League teams, they did that for their players. They would find out, you know, what homes and how many people, and so they would, you know, however many players they would have, because it wasn't, you know, 25 players like modern teams have. It was more like, you know, 12 or something. They would have to find homes for 12 people to live in when they went to a town, and somebody had to figure all that out for the during the Negro League days.
Yeah, and you hear about these things, and in school we learned about this sort of stuff, this sort of segregation in the abstract, you know, in the vague sense that it was going on. But
I was in a conservative part of New Jersey. They didn't.
The reality of it.
I was in a conservative part of New Jersey. They never mentioned it at all.
Oh, okay, all right. Well, I think they mentioned it a little bit where I grew up, maybe a somewhat more liberal portion of New Jersey. Not very much more liberal, I suspect, but the very practical aspect, you have to get into the practical details before it becomes really real in your understanding of the period. And that's why actually one of the great things I've seen with the Green Book is you put it in somebody's hand and it's like you can see the holding of this practical document.
Yeah.
It sort of dawns on people what it means and what it was really like to be limited to these places and having to figure out how to go through these places in order to get anywhere.
Yeah, clearly it was meant to be read with a map. You know, because if it just is somebody's name and their address, you better know how to get there.
You better know how to get there. Well,
yeah, so obviously they're assuming.
Back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, and back then gas stations gave out maps of their state. So clearly, you get an SO map and you get to have the Green Book and figure out how to get someplace. And there's also little articles in the Green Book. And
there's a little travel, depending on what year you get. You get a lot of travel articles. This is what like New York City is. And you see some interesting places to go in New York City. This is what San Francisco is like, and what it's like to things that are available for African Americans in San Francisco. And sometimes there's just car reviews and other things. There's a range of stuff added to the book.
Yeah, there's a little editorial content. And, of course, I went to the points of interest in New York City and read through that. And, you know, WBAI has a show called Golden Age of Radio, which is on every Sunday from 7 to 9. And I have noticed that whenever Chinatown comes up in one of those old radio shows, there's like spooky music or people are like afraid to go to Chinatown. And as someone who goes to Chinatown regularly and just loves to eat there and loves to shop there, I've always wondered what was going on that it was accepted that Chinatown was a scary place. You didn't want to go to at night. And then I read in the Green Book about Chinatown. And I'm like, wow, this fits right in with Golden Age of Radio. At the Bowery and Chatham Square, so Chinatown was way smaller back then, is New York's Oriental section. Sightseeing buses will take visitors there from Times Square, showing the bloody corner at Pell and Mott Streets, which have been the place of countless murders caused by the rivalry of the Long and Hipsing-Tongs. And I'm thinking, well, if this book is recommending people visit Chinatown, but do it in a tour bus, obviously the scariness of it was pretty pervasive. And if there was murders going on, yeah, I could see that. And they tended not to murder tourists. They tended to murder other Tong members, but nevertheless, who wants to see that? I'm going to go eat somewhere, but let me step around this body.
But then you also realize that sometimes, I mean, we've seen that with black neighborhoods or something, that the violence gets exaggerated or made legendary, or it's kept in people's minds long after the neighborhood has changed.
Well, I know there are people who today are scared to go to Chinatown or New York City. And I've asked them why, and they're like, I don't know. I just don't want to go there.
I certainly heard a lot of New Yorkers who are watching the Netflix Marvel series set in Hell's Kitchen.
Oh, no.
And they're like, well, that's Hell's Kitchen 1970s still in the Marvel series. That's not the Hell's Kitchen of today. It's not that sort of dangerous place. But the dangerous place makes for good pulp storytelling.
Yeah, right. And the one of the points of interest is like the Museum of Natural History and the Bronx Zoo, Museum of Science and History, but not the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which is the most popular tourist destination in New York City today. And I thought that was interesting, and I talked to a friend of mine who works there, and she said that way back they would have certain days of the week that black people were welcome to come to the museum, which of course says that the other days of the week, black people were not welcome to go to the Met. And
of course, because you had to keep all the white people comfortable.
Right. And Sidney Smith said that he's never been to the Met. He has no inclination to go there. He kind of shies away from it. And a lot of the places that sort of follow Jim Crow, even in New York City, he won't go to even today, even though it's changed hands several times. This is just sort of this uncomfortableness when he thinks about the Metropolitan Museum of Art. It extends all these years later.
That is understandable. Yeah, that is understandable.
2 years after Jim Crow legally ended. Not that it did end, but it legally ended then.
It was not legally required or permitted, but it goes on anyway in its own way. But yeah, there were certainly places that were willing to accept black customers in some form, but still practice racist policies. The 1962 Green Book, which I most recently reprinted, has for the first time a listing for Anaheim, California, and the one location they list in Anaheim, California, is Disneyland. Disneyland was willing to take the black customers in at the park and in the hotels. But one thing they weren't doing was they weren't hiring a lot of African Americans to work there. They take your money, but they didn't want Main Street USA to be maintained by people of color. And that's not speaking for the Disney organization as a whole. The Disney organization as a whole did have, I know a guy named Floyd Norman, who was one of their animators back then. They were still only partially non-racist, or however you want to view that.
Must be interesting to look through the changes in the country by looking at green books as the years went on.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you see growth in certain things. The green book created economic opportunity for a lot of people because you could open a motel for black Americans and have a place to effectively let them know you're there.
Yeah,
or you could sit there and see a town that didn't have any places for them to dine, and that's an opportunity.
Right.
To a businessman, that's an opportunity. If we can get away with opening a place here, there are going to be people who need to eat.
There was plenty of ads in the Green Book. It reminds me a lot of the modern-day gay Yellow Pages, which lists places around the country that are not homophobic and you can feel comfortable going to. And, again, there are ads in the Gay Yellow Pages, so it's the same thing.
Yeah.
And I wonder,
people want to reach out to that market, yeah, absolutely.
And I also wonder if one of the reasons the Green Book ended in 67, which was 2 years after Jim Crow legally ended, is that they didn't have the ads. You didn't need to have the ads because everybody could go everywhere, supposedly. So, and I'm just wondering if their ad revenue dropped down tremendously after 65, after the Civil Rights Act, and that's why they stopped publishing.
I really don't have access to that information, unfortunately, but I'm curious about, too, how it all went down, how what happened to their total copy sales, what happened to their ad sales. And, you know, by that point, Victor Green, the guy who had founded the Green Book, that's why it's named the Green Book.
Right.
It usually had a green cover, but it was named the Green Book because of it, and sometimes it actually had green printing on the inside instead of black.
Oh, really?
But it was called the Green Book, yes. I haven't reprinted any of those years. It becomes a little trickier to get it authentic. But he had died in 1960. So it was in other hands, it was people who were trying hard, but maybe not have been so as committed to it as he was.
Yeah, he died at, age 68.
Mm-hmm. He started the Green Book in 1936, just covering the New York area, because he was a postman. He lived in New York City. He was a postman in Hackensack, New Jersey, somewhere in New Jersey. But he lived in New York City and just started a local one and then grew it out nationally. And he was a bit of a hustler, too. He started a travel agency. And so he started seeing more and more international locations listed in the Green Book that I, as best as I can tell, link to the fact that he was selling cruises and flights to these locations also to his agency.
Uh-huh. It's an interesting read. And of course, when I was at the museum exhibit, I looked through the 1940 edition. I looked through the 1964 edition. And I noticed a whole lot more ads in the 64 edition. And somebody took a bunch of green books and tried to find if any of the businesses listed were still in existence. And he said, I think 80% of them no longer existed.
Which is not that surprising because things like restaurants, they go out of business easily. But also you've got to figure that if you were had a black specialty motel and suddenly African Americans were free to stay in any hotel, or at least freer, and you know, were legally free to stay in any hotel. That's going to hurt your business. You built your business around being available for people who had no other options.
Right. Another analogy with the Negro Leagues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if people could see the best black ball players on major league teams, why see minor league teams and through the Negro Leagues? I personally wish the Negro Leagues had continued longer because it would have been a great independent league. That's not what happened.
I keep on saying that if the NBA takes on three female players, it'll kill the WNBA.
I
think it should. I'm saying that suddenly all the attention will be, oh, there are, you know, three women good enough to play with the big boys, and it would kill it. But
and you're listening to Jim Freund's Hour of the Wolf on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I'm Ken Gale, subbing for Jim Freund. He'll be back next week. And my guest is Nat Gertler, who is the publisher and I guess everything else here of aboutcomics.com.
Yeah, I am all about comics, and that actually is part of what lets me do things like reprint the Green Book, despite being officially or originally a comics publisher, is there's nobody here to tell me no.
People who have heard me on BAI talking about comics, may find this amusing because I'm looking through the Green Book because I'm into, you know, history and history of ordinary people rather than, you know, kings and presidents. And I'm looking through this, and then I see on the back page, Captain Billy's Whiz Bang. And I'm like, what? And then I'm seeing it's about comics.com. What? And I did not know about you before that. And went to the website and saw all the things you did. And then days later, Jim Freund emails me and said, can you do Hour of the Wolf on the 28th? And here I am talking to Nat Gertler about comics.com.
There we go.
And Captain Billy's Whiz Bang. Anybody
Captain
who's
Billy's
into... go ahead.
Was a humor magazine back in the first half of the 20th century. And it does have a comics link.
It certainly does.
It does, because it was the first publication. Captain Billy was Captain Billy Fawcett. And with the success of Captain Billy's Whiz Bang, which was his first publication, he launched basically a publishing company that, among other things, published Fawcett comics, including, most notably, the character we now call Shazam, but was then known as Captain Marvel, who was Billy Batson, Captain Billy, who first appeared in Whiz Comics, the Captain Billy Whiz, and when he'd show up, there'd be a lightning strike and a bang.
Right.
So, you know, the seeds for Captain Marvel were in Captain Billy's first publication.
And as a comic book historian, I had been reading that for years and wondered what Captain Billy's Whiz Bang was like. And in my mind, because Captain Marvel is stories, I thought that Captain Billy's Whiz Bang was some sort of pulp fiction magazine. But boy, was I wrong.
Mm-hmm. No, it's mostly jokes. It's got some poetry. It's got some of them have a Hollywood gossip column in them. But mostly it's jokes from the time.
And just sort of stream of consciousness opinions and stream of consciousness talk. There's one article and the one you sent me from February 1922 where he is complaining about a Broadway play in New York City, because he felt it should have been censored more. And then in the same paragraph, he claims that there's too much censorship in movies. And so he had a very limited idea on a woman's role in theater and movies and things like that. It was a very bizarre a little opinion piece reviewing a play. But it's also during Prohibition. So where there are all these jokes about Prohibition, like sort of Henny Youngman type jokes. There was like the revenue agents and I are both after the same thing. We both want to get some booze. The real John Barleycorn of older days is gone but not forgotten. Those of us who knew him best and loved him most stuck with him till the last drop.
That's one of the reasons I like to reprint these things. It really puts you in the time.
It does.
It reminds you know it's not this dry historical document telling you what the time was. It puts you in the time. This is what they were joking about. And yes, that comes with some of the ugliness of the time. There's some very racist things in those old Captain Billies. But it really does drop you right in there. And it lets you know, one of the jokes I was fascinated with, and I remember, I reprinted just two Captain Billy volumes so far, but in one of them, there's a couple of jokes, actually, I think, about the boys in San Francisco. And these are gay jokes. These are jokes about them being gay. And I hadn't realized that the San Francisco's reputation as for homosexuality goes back all the way to the 1920s, at least. I sort of thought that was maybe a post-Stonewall understanding, but goes to show how little I know.
It is. I always felt that the study of popular culture tells you more about a country and about history than what speeches are made by presidents and kings. And and that is why I think comic books are valid for study, just as movies are, just as fiction novels are, and humor books like Captain Billy's Whiz Bang. I I found it interesting that jokes that I recognize today as being Polish jokes were not Polish jokes in 1922. They were Italian jokes and they were Irish jokes. Mm-hmm. But they were pretty much word for word what you hear now as Polish jokes or whatever the next ethnic that you want to say is stupid.
And a lot of them would be, yeah, a lot of them would be great jokes if we actually had some generic non-existing people that we would feel fun of
right.
as a bunch of stupid folks. But there's nothing particularly Polish about the subway with a screen door or the pilots landing on a runway that is so short. But look how wide it is. These fit in with any, hey, these guys are stupid. Idea. And that may not be a totally healthy thing to do, but some of them are, despite that, funny.
And so, I was surprised to see that type of humor about Irish people, because we're talking 1922. The potato famine is the 40s. And the Nina stuff, where they would put out a classified ad, and at the end of it would put NINA, No Irish Need Apply. And this mm-hmm. was accepted way of doing business in the 40s, 50s, and into the 60s. And still, Irish jokes are being made in the 1920s. So we're talking, 50 years later, 60 years later. And so...
But even back then, you had the Pat and Mike stuff on the vaudeville stage.
Yeah.
So...
And there's a couple of Pat and Mikes in that Captain Willie's Billy's Whiz Bang.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting to sort of try to put into context. There's a wonderful museum in New York City called the Tenement Museum. And what you get is a history of immigration in America from 1860 until 1935, when this building... a tenement building on the Lower East Side closed down. And there were just waves of ethnic immigration.
Mm-hmm. And every time you got a new wave from a different place, suddenly those folks were the villains somehow.
Right, and the previous villains...
We wouldn't be doing that today, of course, in any way, shape, or form, but back then.
Yeah. It is interesting to go through that museum, which is a building, a tenement building, and see how the country changed, and yet it didn't. The attitudes towards poor people, the fact that there's always somebody from the home country that speaks your language willing to exploit you. I remember a friend of mine married a woman from India like 20 years ago, and he was boasting about the money he was making in construction, and it was a fraction of what a white Anglo-Saxon person would make in construction, a fraction. But he thought it was a lot of money because it was more money than he would have made if he were still in India. So there's always somebody to exploit you. Because
mm-hmm.
they know.
Yeah, and that's a double-edged sword, because exploitation in that case is also opportunity. It's not an opportunity as good as everybody else is getting, but it gets the group's foot in the door. So
right.
It's just part of the whole messy history of things.
It certainly is, and a lot of that stuff is still going on. I mean, there's human trafficking going on all over the world to this day. I do Ecologic, and I did a show on that was about human trafficking and TPP and deforestation, and there are more people enslaved in the world today than there was in the height of the slave trade between Africa and North America. However, the percentage of people enslaved is lower than it was in those days.
Yeah, we have more people total.
So right, there's more people total, so the percentage is down, but the number is greater. But it's much more hidden. I think it was sort of like, yeah, of course we have slaves back in the 1860s. Nowadays it's like, oh, no, we don't. No, we don't. Don't go behind that door. And so, reading a mass market magazine, you really get to know what people were thinking. I remember talking to a historian when I was a young writer in my early 20s, and I wanted to write a book that took place during the American Civil War. And this guy, he was my friend's father, who taught American history specializing in the Civil War. I said, so what book should I read for research? And he said, read plays. If you read the plays that came out at the time, you will learn more about what the country was like than any history book I could recommend to you.
Ooh, that's nice.
And this was a historian saying this to me, and I took it to heart, and I have repeated that recommendation more times than I could possibly count. And but again, it's the average person. A play has to appeal to the average person who goes to plays. And so
it also has to depict what's happening to a person, where so much of history is written is what happens to bodies of power.
Right. What caused this war and what caused that war and what was the aftermath of that war? But what about what people were doing, you know, every day? And, you know, popular culture can't be popular unless it addresses what people are thinking about at that time. And so, you know, you can look over popular culture and see, boy, they talked about religion an awful lot. Oh, they're not talking about religion so much anymore. And of course, you know, what was religion over in this era is mysticism in another era. And so you understand what is going on in whatever country, popular culture you're reading about.
Yeah, absolutely. Popular culture is great, great. One of the things I reprinted, was it last year? It was recently. I had found a collection, a very small print run collection, of cartoons about being a World War II veteran going to college on the GI Bill, done by somebody who was a World War II. This was college newspaper stuff done by a World War II veteran who was in there on the GI Bill. And so he's taking you directly, I mean, he's making fun of his experiences. He's obviously, his cartoon is played broadly, it's played for laughs. But he's also, you know, you're seeing that perspective of somebody whose boots are on, you know, literal boots are literally on the ground there.
Mm.
So, you know, I pop culture is full of things like that. So that's a book called Vic the Vet. That I don't think anybody had mentioned, you know, when it was first out, it was just, oh, here's something that's going on, and you know, here's the local cartoons about it. And I think, you know, the time has made it much more interesting, just as a window to things that seemed every day to people then.
Right. Dick the Vet.
Dick the Vet. It's by Dave Josephson. He went on for a career as a professional cartoonist, but this was his college paperwork.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I found that old collection, expanded it with a few cartoons that weren't in the collection, but also added a lot of explanations, a lot of, you know, commentary, just like, oh, here's what they're referring to then. You know, this joke, you know, this was referring to a song that was on the radio at the moment. This sort of patch was worn, was something that military people would put on their military jackets when they got put out of the military. They were allowed to still wear their military jackets if they added this patch. You know, things like that just made it aspects of it clear for people.
That is interesting. You had to wear a patch, huh?
Yeah. You weren't allowed to wear your military uniform if you were no longer in the military, but this, they also realized that people just getting out of the military didn't have necessarily a lot of money or a lot of other clothes
right.
available to them immediately. So you had that option.
The other thing I noticed about the 1922 Captain Billy's Whiz Bang was, it's some of it is like vaudeville in print,
mm-hmm.
With corny jokes and things, but also a lot of insults toward marriage, both from the male and female perspective.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, getting married was something that you didn't want to do. Although somehow people always managed to do that, but it was
you were supposed to back then.
We
had a little less urgency on it today, but that was something you were supposed to do as part of growing up and getting older. This is how a woman made sure to have access to money is that she became somebody's bride. It was, you know, there were some jobs available certainly, but there were limitations on that. But being a wife was open to everybody if you're a female.
Well, it's interesting in that, like, there was one that women who cry at weddings are people who've been married. So
yeah.
Obviously, it's like he's saying that, well, a woman doesn't want to get married, actually. It's not it. And then there's one, I had a dream that you ran off with another man. And, oh, what did you do? I asked him why he was running. And so it's sort of like, okay, so, you know, he's making fun of men who get married and making fun of women who get married. And those kinds of jokes just pepper this magazine throughout, which is interesting. And then whenever he wants to talk about a unattractive woman, he refers to as a bow-legged girl. And I don't know the last time I saw the term bow-legged to describe anybody. But
he definitely had his humor riffs that the whiz bang went back to again and again.
But it's obviously something that people understood, that if you mm-hmm. call her bow-legged, she's unattractive, period. Because then the joke could go on from there. Once you set the stage that the female character in this joke is not attractive. So I'm like, you know, when you look at vaudeville or read about vaudeville, and then you listen to Golden Age of Radio, and this sort of fills in the gap, because Golden Age of Radio, early 20s, Max doesn't play much of anything from the early 20s. So you're sort of seeing what people are like back then during Prohibition, and yet there's plenty of jokes about drunks in here. Right, nobody's supposed to be drinking, but there's all these jokes about drunks. So obviously, people are still drinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, this is supposed to be a body humor magazine, so you know.
Well, not too body, because
the sins of the time.
He doesn't like things to be too body. He complains about it.
Well, yeah, but for its time, I mean, I've got some later volumes.
Yes.
They're printing French postcard pictures and things like that. So it was meant for men. It was meant to be edgy for compared to other things that were available. This was not your Saturday Evening Post. So you know, it was drinking humor, stuff like that. This was being sold to men on the train. So you know, it had to feel like it had that edge. But compared to anything we do today, it's both mild and it's mild on some fronts and on things like racial stereotyping. It's horrible on some fronts.
Yeah,
but it was interesting, and in fact, the reason a lot of people know about Captain Billy's Whiz Bang is it's mentioned in The Music Man, the play The Music Man. That is the sign that your son is behaving badly. He's getting jokes from Captain Billy's Whiz Bang is mentioned in the play, and that's actually a little anachronistic, because The Music Man actually takes place a couple of years before the first issue of Whiz Bang, but by the time they were writing Music Man, this was recognized as, oh, okay, that's your search for relatively dirty jokes at the time. That's the thing your mother doesn't want you reading.
Right. And you're listening to Jim Froyen's Hour of the Wolf. I'm guest hosting. I'm Ken Gale, and I'm interviewing Nat Gertler of About Comics, who publishes books about comics, and he publishes comics themselves, and he also publishes things that are not comics and slices of history, such as the Negro Motorist Green Book and Captain Billy's Whiz Bang from 1940 and 1922, respectively. And let's go back to the comic stuff. You're the creator of the 24-hour comic book.
No, I'm the
creator
of 24-hour comics day.
Oh, comics day.
I created 24-hour comic book.
Okay, got it.
What happened was in the 1990s, Scott was hanging out with a guy called Steve Bissett, who's known for his work on Swamp Thing. He was also known for being a very slow comics artist. He wasn't necessarily the sort of guy who would get an issue out every month. And Scott would see him at a signing, and he'd be doing these sketches in 10 minutes.
Hmm? Scott who?
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. Scott McCloud. Scott McCloud. McCloud would see him at a signing and would see him whipping off these 10-minute sketches that were beautiful. And Scott was like, well, if you can do a 10-minute sketch you could do six of those in an hour, and that's a page, six drawings of a page of comics. So I bet you could do in 24 hours a 24-page comic book. And so they had a challenge, and in the first year they both did that. They
what,
tried.
What year was that?
Thinking 94. I'd have to double check. But other people heard about the challenge and were doing them on and off of, you know, various ways over the next decade. You know, Dave Sim did one, and you know, lots of people did them, pros and amateurs alike, just as sort of a challenge to themselves, and it's a learning experience.
Yep.
And people kept going up to Scott and saying, you know, somebody should do a book collection of these. And I was the guy who went up to Scott and said, you know what, I'd like to do a book collection of these. And so Scott McCloud, the author of Understanding Comics, which is a great graphic novel about how comics works as a medium. But he agreed, and he edited a volume collecting those. And I said, you know what we should do? We should have an event just at some comic shop where we get a bunch of people together to do 24-hour comics. And that way we can get some press coverage, probably, you know, just the comics press, the Comics Buyer's Guide, Wizard Magazine, whatever it was at the time.
Right.
And I put that idea in front of some retailers to find out which one would be willing to do it. And within 24 hours, I had over a dozen retailers wanting to do it. And I said, well, I can't go around to a dozen different places on different days and do this. Hey, how about we just announce a day, have you all do it on the same day, and it becomes a thing. And that was 2004. April 24th, 2004 was the first 24-hour comics day. And when it got done, retailers said, that was great. When's next year's? And I was like, I didn't know this was annual. Okay, I guess I better organize that. And so every year since 2004, there's been a 24-hour comics day. It's been moved into the fall. I'm no longer running it. I ran it for the first 4 years, and I passed it over to Comics Pro, which is a comics retailer organization. But this thing is international. This thing is all over the globe that people take part in this. And every year, there, you know, we get something like 1,000 or so cartoonists taking part in 24-hour comics a day, whether they're gathering at a local event, which is a lot of fun, you're working side by side with people all through the night, or whether they're doing it at home. And there's, you know, tens of thousands of pages of comics art created. Not everybody completes 24 pages. That's the goal. Not everybody does it.
Right.
But a failure in 24-hour comics day means you create a relatively large pile of art for a day's worth of work.
Yeah, my friend E.J. Barnes takes part in, or used to take part in it. She did it for several years. And she did not always do 24 pages in 24 hours, and sometimes she did. And finally she decided, she was doing it to sort of, you know, kick herself in the rear to get more art done. She would feel that, I'm not drawing enough, and she would take the challenge of doing 24 pages in 24 hours. And she's published several comics as a result of 24-hour comics day, even whether she finished them in 24 hours or not. She did a comic book called Birds of the Baltic, about a trip she took to the Baltic and a bird that she couldn't figure out what it was. And she started it on 24-hour comics day, didn't finish it in 24 hours, but she still managed to get a comic out of it. And she said she would not have gotten that if she hadn't sort of taken the motivation of 24-hour comics day.
And, oh, yeah, and there's a lot of great work has come out of that. I mean, that EJ was doing that material. She's talented indeed.
Right.
But there's for the first 3 years we published anthologies collecting what we called highlights. You know, just I wouldn't want to say the best because everybody did put a lot of heart into it. But I'd pick a few stories and publish them in an anthology. And like in those anthologies, we have the first published work by Fiona Staples, the Yalda Saga. We had an early Faith Erin Hicks. We had Kevin Cannon did the first of his Army Shanks stories, which he later went on to do two full graphic novels featuring this character, which he was, and the graphic novels, he continued drawing one page per hour. You know, he didn't do the whole graphic novel at a sitting, but he would do one page per hour to keep that same sort of style. So the effect in terms of that has been great. There's a lot of people, this is the first time they do any comics, and that gets them down that road, and that's great. And it's just been fun to watch the fallout from this, what was started off as a purely promotional thing, but is going to be so much more.
It reminds me of writers' workshops and writers' retreats, where a bunch of writers get together and just write for days on end, and sort of are writing for each other and are spurred to pretty high creativity because they're always thinking about writing. And here for 24 hours, you're only thinking about doing a comic.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's inspired people in other realms. The creator of the 24-hour plays, for example, admits it was because of Scott McCloud's 24-hour comics challenge that she launched that. And that's something that goes on across the nation on different days, with various sites getting together and creating a bunch of short plays that are performed 24 hours after they started getting written. There's 24-hour film projects. There's all kinds of other things going on, generally inspired by Scott McCloud's 24-hour comics invention.
That's pretty neat, too. I had not realized that it inspired so many other people in other art forms. That's pretty cool. And, of course, you've got a graphic novel of four of yours. Is it all four of yours or just four of yours?
All four of mine, and I don't expect anybody to buy it. I just sort of put it out so I can say, hey, here they are, they're done, if I ever want to show them to people. Before I approached Scott McCloud about putting together that first book of 24-hour comics, I realized I could not ask him to do that unless I'd walk the walk myself. So that's when I did my first 24-hour comic. And then I ran the 24-hour comics day event for several years, so I really couldn't participate. So once I handed over the reins the next 3 years, I did a 24-hour comic each year. And the first three of mine were all done digitally, using Photoshop or Illustrator or things like that. And I figured, well, that's legitimate, but it's also sort of cheating. I make my life easier. I can sit there and say, oh, I use a good character here. Let's copy him to all the other panels, things like that. So the fourth year, I did it strictly by hand, and then strictly black and white then, because when you're doing Photoshop, when you're doing it digitally, it's very easy to quickly color. It's not so much when you're doing it by hand. So those four are available in a single volume called 96, because that's 24 times 4.
And I noticed the writing is very stream of consciousness.
You got to keep going when you're doing it. You know, you can't stop. Some of them more so than others. But I'm really proud. I would often start by opening up a magazine or something and picking two words at random and building around that. That made sure I wasn't bringing an idea in. I wanted to start with nothing. So I think there's one story there called Percentage Due, and those were the words that I picked out at random from some magazine, and it happened to be during the housing collapse.
Right.
I ended up doing this entire comic story about fish involved in the housing collapse. So I'm actually bizarrely proud of that one.
Well, you managed to get some political commentary in a way that's not going to make someone who doesn't want to hear about it uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is always a wonderful thing if you can do it. And you're talking about the nature of time in one of them. And sort of the nature of fire in another, and then you did a fairy tale.
Yeah, let me publicly state that the story I do about being a bit of an arsonist at my synagogue as a child is totally fictional. Let me make that clear. Totally, utterly fictional. Never was a fire kid. I was not burning baseball cards out behind the synagogue.
No, they were football cards.
Oh, okay. I don't even remember. Sometimes I don't look at these things for a while. Some of them are a little painful. but I'm not generally an artist. I'm a comics writer generally, but not I'm not professional quality art by any stretch of the imagination. So this is forcing myself to at least do enough rendering to make the story be told.
Right.
And I think it's good for people in comics to sometimes try what everybody else does, because it'll help you understand what the difficulties are with what they do.
That's what Peter O'Donnell said when he was writing the Modesty Blaze comic strip for several decades, And he said he would always draw the strip to make sure he wasn't asking the artist to draw something that couldn't be done.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's a wise idea. I don't think everybody has to do it all the time, but it's a good idea to try that from time to time. And I've done stories when I was working on some Jetsons comics that I would do a drawn script, which just to see how that worked, just to learn how to do that.
It also helps you think visually when you're actually drawing. And Mercy Van Vlack was writing Richie Rich for Harvey, and she said that their scripts were actually drawn. You don't present a typewritten script. You present layouts with dialogue on it.
And then that's when I did Jetsons, it was actually coming through the Harvey offices. It was sort of this weird setup where Sid Jacobson, who was one of the key Harvey guys, was editing Hanna-Barbera comics for Archie to publish. This is one of these weird way comic business works things. And so that's why I did some of them written scripts, the Flintstones mostly written scripts, but for the Jetsons I tried drawn scripts, both because I thought that's what was expected of me and because I wanted the experience of doing that.
Mm.
And when Jim another thing for force myself to be visual, I did some silent comics, series called stories called Jenny City, of which only a couple have been drawn, and they're available as a book, which is about a little girl wakes up in a city and discovers that everybody's gone. The only living things left in the city are her and cats. And because there's no other characters, there's no one to speak to, really. There's no dialogue. So it's all action. It's all visual. And that was something I chose partly to force myself to make sure I think visual as a comics writer. But it was also inspired by some silent material, a series called Gone, which is a Japanese series. That was just, it's about animals, so it's all visual. It's, you know, there's no dialogue. And I wanted to see if I could do that.
And last but not least, you published Charles Schulz, but not Peanuts, another comic strip he did, or a few comic strips he did.
A few other projects he did. He did in 1957 through 1959, he did a single-panel cartoon series for newspapers called It's Only a Game. And he drew it himself for the first while, and then after a while, he would do roughs, and he had somebody working in a studio who would finish them, a guy named Jim Sasseville.
That's the guy who drew the Peanuts comic books.
He was one of the guys who drew the Peanuts comic books, yes. And so this stuff had never been reprinted in any significant way. There were a couple of little pamphlets put out. We're not even sure when. We just know they exist. That had a handful of cartoons in them, but there hadn't been any book collections of them. So I put out a book collection of them a fair while back, and then I updated it with a color edition.
And it's all of them, right?
It's all of them. It's a complete run. It's from the very first one in 57 to the last one in 59. And the color reprints the Sunday versions in color, which each week there'd be three individual single panel gags plus a little mini gag. In some cases, I only had a black and white version to go from, so I had to create the color myself. In other cases, it's scanned color from published editions. And so it's great to have that out because it's Charles Schulz. This is one of the most, possibly the most important strip cartoonists going and somebody whose work I love. I'm an insane Peanuts fan. I have literally over 1,000 Peanuts books in my collection. I have a blog about Peanuts books. I do a weekly podcast about Peanuts books. I help other publishers put together Peanuts books. I appear on some of the Peanuts DVDs and the, you know, bonus features and one of the talking heads talking about Peanuts. So I'm that guy. That is my insanity. And to me, the fact that there was other Charles Schulz stuff lying around that was never in book form or hadn't been in a book form in a long time was that didn't make any sense to me. So, for example, I reprinted a book called Dear President Johnson, which is kids' letters to LBJ. that it's got Schultz illustrations. And you can certainly understand why there's less interest, was less interest in that after LBJ was no longer president. You know, that was a sort of a temporary thing out there. But I reprinted it, and because I can work print on demand, I don't need to have big piles of them or sell big piles of them. And those most notably sell through the Schultz Museum and the LBJ Museum. So right. I can target markets like that, you know, and it's worthwhile. And that was fun to get back out.
I thought it was fascinating to read It's Only a Game and see adult versions of Charlie Brown and Linus and Lucy and everybody. So for you, it must have been incredibly wonderful to see them as adults, so to speak.
Yeah, it's fun to see the sort of stretched out version of the Schultz characters. I saw a lot of that. Before I published It's Only a Game, I published a book called Schultz's Youth, and that collected cartoons he did about teenagers for Christian publications. And you know, he did those for over a decade. And some of them had been reprinted in a few books before, but none of those books were in print, and there were definitely cartoons out there that had never been in those books. So I put out a single volume with the most complete collection. That is unfortunately no longer in print. I had licensed those from the church publisher that held the rights, and my license time ran out. But if anybody's interested in them, they're still available on the used market. And if you haven't seen Schultz drawing teenagers, they do look very much like somebody took some of the Peanuts characters and stretched them, you know, yanked them taller. But there's also a lot of very funny stuff in there. Plus, I included in there some cartoons he did about 2 to 4 year old kids for a church publication called 2 to 4s that he had co-written about little kids and the church.
And I'm looking at the very first It's a Game, and the middle panel has got someone who looks an awful lot like an older version of Charlie Brown, and he's acting like Charlie Brown, saying, "I think I'm going to cry," complaining about his golf ball not going in, just barely not going in.
Yeah, and that's very much a Schultz-y expression. That's very much a Schultz-y sensibility.
Yeah.
But you know, the things that were driving this series, people getting a little too involved in their sports and games. You know, you see that in Peanuts too. You see Charlie Brown's absolute dedication to baseball games. He's never going to win. So
yep, Schroeder is being absolutely dedicated to his piano and Beethoven.
So yeah, so I've got the It's Only a Game collection out, and also one cartoon every week was about the card game Bridge. Back when Schultz first pitched this series, it was just going to be a cartoon series about Bridge, and the syndicate just wanted something more. So I took all the Bridge panels and put them out in just a separate collection in black and white aimed at Bridge fans. So we had and that's an example where I put it out because why not give it a try, and for a while there it didn't sell very much, and then I found the ways to publicize it, I found the way folks to distribute it to, and it's sold a lot more since. In fact, some Bridge tournaments bought piles of copies to give to everybody at the tournament. I do custom covers for them. That's another nice thing about print on demand, is you sit there and change a cover and put out a couple hundred copies without much problem. So that was, you know, that has worked out well for me.
And it was interesting to read all the cartoons and realize that team sports they're not in there very often.
Not a lot. No, there's only like a couple of football in there, and there's
a couple, you know, of hockey, no basketball.
Yeah, he did he did a little bit of basketball in the teen stuff, but just a little bit. But he likes doing bowling. He likes doing other things, and there's everything. You know, there's Monopoly, and there's people just with all kinds of little games. Croquet. There's several about croquet.
Yeah, a lot about bowling. A huge number of bowling cartoons, and there's even one on curling.
Absolutely. And that was well before it was fashionable, because basically curling became fashionable this year in the U.S., but it's in there.
From 1957.
It was things that Schultz himself was a big sports guy. He was very much into his golf. He was very much into his hockey. But the hockey is only somewhat reflected.
Yeah, there's not that much hockey. A lot of ice fishing, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, clearly somebody who came from a cold climate like, say, Minnesota.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, yeah. It was fun stuff to be able to put out and to find a home for it. I just like don't like stuff lying around where nobody can see it. I want it to be out there. The About Comics motto is officially publishing things that ought to be published. And sometimes it's important that this be published. Like in Green Book, it's practically important that this be published. And
yeah.
Sometimes it's, why not? There's no reason not to have this available.
Yeah,
some of what I do is very serious, and some of what I do is, why not?
Well, the young woman who was sort of the main staff person at the museum that I saw the Green Book exhibit, she's young. And she had never heard of the Green Book, and so when the exhibit happened, and she's looking at it, and she's black, and so she asked her grandmother about it, and then she learned all about the Green Book, and she was just fascinated that this was happening, and she's like, once you learn about it, you go, well, of course a book like that would exist, it would almost have to exist.
People find ways to make things work, and that's a your example of it right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you mentioned, licensing some Charles Schulz cartoons from a church, and of course you have an entire graphic novel kind of making fun of licensing a little bit.
Oh, absolutely. Licensable Bear. The Little Bear Just Wants to Be Licensed for Products. I did that as a comic book series, just one issue a year for 4 years there, and I've collected them all into that trade paperback as well as some Licensable Bear stories that had appeared elsewhere. And it was just a fun thing. It was, well, you read a lot of the Harvey comics, your Little Lotta, Little Dot. You take somebody with a specific fascination and you view the entire world through that fascination. And Licensable Bear is just a cartoon character that wants to be licensed for products. It's why most cartoon characters exist these days. He's just the one who's honest about it. And once you have that strong point of view, you can look at a lot of things through that lens, and that was a very fun series to do.
Yeah, you made a lot of comments about what copyright and trademark are and what licensing is and what intellectual property is and what it's not. And then you stopped being serious about it and started doing pun after pun after pun. I mean, was that because you were, done being serious about it or what? You totally switched gears.
It's always supposed to be fun. I do have a few serious comments in there, and I do also have some.
Oh, they're very good serious comments.
But yeah, but it was always meant to be driven by fun. The entire series actually started.
No, I didn't say fun. I said pun.
Oh, pun. Yes. Well,
lots of puns. Right in the middle of the License to Bear graphic novel, it was a lot of your pages ended in puns.
Okay, I guess I'm guilty of wordplay, which may not be the strongest thing for a comics writer, but I'm guilty of it.
Yep. Oh, I'm not saying it's a put down, and I'm subbing for Hour of the Wolf, a science fiction show, and I think we all know that science fiction fans love to pun, and sometimes you'll talk to, you'll be with a science fiction fan and his non-fanish spouse, who is like, oh no, you pun too? Do all of you do that? And I guess we do.
Yeah, I guess we do. Yeah. Well, I'm a writer and playing with words. I mean, words are my tools. I do what I can. I do what I can with it, and sometimes it means looking at them in ways other than what they're meant to be used. How they're meant to be used.
Well, I find it's that science fiction fans were. When I first read the Mabinogion, which is where the original King Arthur and a lot of the Celtic myths come from, where they don't say anything in one sentence, well, if an entire paragraph will say the same thing. And science fiction fans do the same thing. They won't use one sentence if they can go on for several sentences to say the same thing. And I'm like, well, no wonder Celtic mythology is so popular with science fiction fans.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, yes. We talk
Left
a lot.
Yes. Now, in comic books, the entire fight is undoing that. You know, undoing that. It's
right.
To say it as directly as possible, because you're the real estate of a word balloon. That's valuable real estate. You don't want to be blocking too much art. You don't
That's
want to
right.
be reading too much out. You want the words to carry as much of the concept as they need to, as quickly as they can. Let the picture carry whatever weight it can carry.
Yeah, some old-time editors would only allow a certain number of words per word balloon, and you weren't allowed to go over.
Yeah, and that's not a horrible choice. I wrote a book co-wrote a book on creating graphic novels, which was really about comic books. It was just graphic novel was the hot term at the time. And one of the things I said was, you should find a number for yourself and try to stick to it, you know. Excuse me. Because it will keep you from your worst excesses,
right.
And it'll give you a goal, it'll give you a guideline. You won't feel so lost if you find a panel you think works as the maximum you can fit into a panel. Count those words, stick to that.
You know, your description of comics being the opposite of wordiness may explain something I've been wondering about for decades. I was at a convention. I was one of the writer guests at some comic convention, and it was a small convention, and they took all the guests out for dinner the night before the convention.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody, and it was, you know, a bunch of writers and artists and their spouses, and somebody did a line from Monty Python. And then somebody else did the next line from that routine. And then somebody else did the next line from that routine. And then one of the wives went, oh, no, they all know it. And I just found it fascinating, because if you're at a science fiction gathering, a convention, a party, whatever, and someone says a line from Monty Python, everybody in the room will recite the next several lines of that sketch. And I'm
mm-hmm.
thinking, okay, we're both into imaginative literature, we're both into Monty Python, but science fiction fans all say it in unison, comic book fans do one line at a time. And somebody goes, you mean like panels of a story? And I said, yeah, but I think it's got to be more to it than that. And I think you may have hit on it, that it's the brevity of comic book words.
Yeah. Well, if you just say, if each person just says the next line, what they're saying is, here's how many words I need to tell you in order to tell you I know this routine.
Right, yeah. At SF fans, everybody's got to say it. And just keep on going until the routine's done. I've been fascinated by that difference since I first noticed it back in the 90s.
I hadn't noticed that myself, but it makes sense.
It certainly does. So, Nat, you want to take some listener phone calls?
Absolutely.
There's probably somebody is up at this time of night. And
well, you are. You can call me. Oh, you already did. Okay.
Well,
maybe somebody else besides
did.
You.
And I better give the number. It's 347-335-0818. That's 347-335-0818. And what are some other things that... about comics that's been publishing that I just don't happen to have with me?
Well, we reprinted a best-selling book. We reprinted the JFK coloring book, which was a bestseller in the early 60s, and then suddenly, for some reason, sales died on it. Maybe
not the right word to use.
Maybe not the right word, you think? Maybe not. But this is illustrated by Mort Drucker, one of Mad Magazine's great
right?
cartoonists. And this is, you know, hilarious stuff, making fun of the political folks of the day. It's written as if it were a storybook being written by young Carolyn Kennedy. She, of course, actually had nothing to do with it, but it's funny stuff. And as I say, it was on the bestseller list for like 14 weeks.
Wow.
And you know, in 62. And then it's been unavailable since. So I reprinted it, and in fact, it was a fairly thin book, so I added a whole second book of Mort Drucker caricatures, a bunch of different politicians and other famous folks drawn as wind-up dolls, and what they would do as wind-up dolls.
Oh.
And so that's available.
That sounds like something he would do for Mad, but obviously it wasn't.
It's not out of line with the stuff he was doing for Mad. This was published by a company called Canrom. And Canrom did a couple of books, several books with Mort Drucker, and did several books with Sergio Aragonés. So they were very into the Mad sensibility. I reprint The Liberty Project, which is a Kurt Busiek supervillain-turned-superhero series from the 1980s. And it was a very early Kurt Busiek stuff. It's really his first creator-owned material. And
I'm a big fan of Kurt Busiek, so I'm glad that that's still out there.
Yeah. And that was something that I reprinted first when I was still doing standard publication, did a standard book edition, and then I kept it in print by going to print on demand. So that's all still available.
Well, good for you. Oh, and in License of a Bear, I got the impression that you had done a compilation of DN Agents.
I did one volume of DN Agents. I was looking at reprinting the whole series. I did a volume of DN Agents and a volume of Crossfire, which are set in the same universe, two Mark Evanier written books. And the plan was to do a whole series and, you know, reprint large slabs of them. But the sales weren't that great for the first volume, and it came just at a time. And suddenly some other things were going on in my life, such as having my first child, or, you know, my wife was doing the hard work on that one, but I was still somewhat involved. So I decided to set that aside, but we did one volume of piece of those.
When did that come out?
That would be around 2004. I'd have to double check. I'm sorry, I don't have all the time.
I'm wondering because I interviewed Mark Evanier 6 months ago or whenever it was, and talked a lot about DN Agents and Crossfire, and that compilation never came up. And Nuff Said ended as a regular radio show in 2002, and so that's probably why it didn't get onto my radar, because I would love to have talked about it when it came out.
And it's set in the same universe and written by Mark Evanier and drawn by Dan Spiegel, the guy who drew Crossfire.
Yeah.
They did a series called Hollywood Superstars,
right,
published by Epic, and I've got a collection of that out and available now. So, you know, that is still available.
Hollywood Superstars is available, but Crossfire and DN Agents is not.
The Crossfire and DN Agents are out of print.
Okay.
Those were things done before I went print on demand.
Yeah.
And they're no longer out there.
Because when I was thinking, before I finished reading License of a Bear, I was thinking, you know, your comment about things that should exist. And I'm thinking, DN Agents and Crossfire should exist. People should be reading that. Same with Journey by Bill Messner-Loeb. That should still be around.
Well, IDW put out what was almost a complete collection of Journey in two volumes. But one thing they missed was that I did a single-issue anthology. It was actually somebody wanted to underwrite an anthology of new material, so I put it out. And it had a new Journey story and a new Crossfire story by Evanier and Spiegel.
Oh.
It was called Many Happy Returns, because we were bringing things like Journey and Crossfire back out. And that Journey story was not in the IDW Journey collections for some reason. But hopefully it'll find a home somewhere. And hopefully, I don't know if you've heard about William Messner-Loeb. He's the guy who created Journey. He's getting some coverage lately because he's homeless again.
I was bring that up, yeah.
Yeah, one of the early things, About Comics has been publishing for 20 years, and one of the early things we published was a collection of a serial he did called Welcome to Heaven, Dr. Franklin, that had appeared in the back of Cerebus. And Benjamin Franklin dies, goes to heaven, and finds that there's some mad Roman emperor running the place instead of anybody who'd want to be God. And so this is another example of, well, here's a longer story that had never been under, it wasn't that long, it was more like an issue length when you added all the installments together than a graphic novel length, but still it had never been available in a single cover, and all the Cerebus stuff had been reprinted, but this hadn't, and it was like, let's make this available again. that I was glad to do.
Yeah, I'm glad that it's been circulating through Facebook, especially about what's been going on with Bill Mr. Loebs, because he's a really, really great guy, very talented writer, very smart person, and it's terrible when people like that go through the rough patch. And Bill Mr. Loebs, besides doing Journey, which is my favorite of what he did, he also wrote mm-hmm. Wonder Woman for a little while. And, I mean...
He wrote some good Wonder Woman. He wrote a great series of graphic novels called Epicurus the Sage.
Oh, right. But his Wonder Woman, it was very interesting because I'm thinking, when I heard he was doing, I was like, oh, he's like the perfect writer for Wonder Woman. If you can't get George Perez, because... You know, what is he strongest at is characterization and plot. And so, great, you know, Wonder Woman needs to have stories, not situations and not vignettes, but full stories. And it was really nice that they were hiring somebody. And then after a little while, they started telling him to be more modern, quote unquote. What they mm-hmm. wanted him to do was put TNA into Wonder Woman. And he didn't last much longer on the book after that because it's not what he, that's not one what he's best at, and it's not what he likes to do, and it's not appropriate for Wonder Woman anyway. So whoever was the editor, I'm glad I don't remember his name. Did not understand what they were doing. You don't hire a person who does characterization and plot, and there's not enough of them. To do TNA, but anyway, Bill Mr. Loebs, look for his work, look for his name on the internet, and you'll discover a talent that maybe you didn't know about before.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Let's see, some other things I published. There was a series of Jewish James Bond parodies and parody novels. It first appeared in Playboy, called Israel Bond Oi Oi 7 by Sol Weinstein. And I reprinted that entire series. That's something that's not comics, but I read them growing up, or I read the ones that I knew about growing up, or discovered that there was at least one more volume than what I knew about, but it was very hard to find copies of it. So it was a rare fourth volume. So I reprinted that whole series working with the original author, who unfortunately has since
And we
passed.
Did get a listener phone call.
Oh, cool.
So, 347-335-0818, and you're on the air.
Hello, gentlemen. This has been an edifying, wonderful discussion.
Thank you.
Glad to hear it.
I'm supposed to be asleep. My doctor's telling me I need to get more sleep, and WPAI is keeping me up too many nights. But I wanted to know two things. You said that the comics are available, your books are available on demand, and I don't know if you already said that, and also the name of the museum for the Green Book. I know about the Green Book. I'm 79 years old.
Ah, well, yeah.
And we used to travel from Florida to New York every summer, and my mother would go over and rehearse and plan tremendously what we had to do, where we had to stop. So I would love to share this with my grandchildren and great-grandchildren.
Now, was using the Green Book a matter of life or death? Did you think of it that way? Did you think of using the Green Book as a matter of life and death?
Yeah. Because that's the way my mother had been in New York for a long time, and then she moved to Florida.
Yeah, Sidney Smith said the same thing.
You couldn't afford anything to go very wrong. You had to be prepared for everything. Because if you're a white person, something goes a little wrong, there's plenty of folks to help you, plenty of places to go. And that wasn't true, unfortunately, for you and your mother at the time. But, yeah, the all of my books are available most easily through Amazon. If you do a search for Green Book on Amazon, these editions will pop right up. The museum that we're talking about is the Museum of Arts and Design.
Oh.
It's on Columbus Circle. It's on the southern end of Columbus Circle. So, you know, 59th Street. There's a little little tiny block that basically has one building on it between Broadway and 8th Avenue, between 59th and Columbus Circle. And that's where that museum is.
Okay. How do you spell Nat's name?
Go ahead, Nat.
How do you spell the last name?
My last name is G-E-R-T-L-E-R, but you won't need that in order to find them. In fact, if you're searching on Amazon, they're under the author Victor H. Green. So you search for him, or just search for the word Green Book, and it'll pop up. Or if you go to the museum, they have copies in the gift shop.
Oh, really?
Yes, they have, I think, three different editions in the gift shop.
I want to spell his name again. Spell it again. G-E-R.
G-E-R-T-L-E-R.
Oh, okay. I did have it right.
Kertzler.
Matt Kertzler.
You are saying G as in green.
Yes.
I'm saying G as in green, E as in elephant, R as in riding an elephant, T as in take that elephant out of here, L as in leave that elephant alone, E as in elephants like to eat very strange things, and R is means rutabagas. So that's
Kertzler. We got to make this discussion. This should be a premium. This discussion was phenomenal.
Well, thank you. A few people, I talked about the show on Ecologic last night, and I had people saying that I can't be up at 1 in the morning, but can you get me a copy or tell me what the link is for the archive? And at 305, 310, you'll be able to hear this entire discussion on WBAI.org.
I know. I use the archives all the time.
Well, I know you know, but not everybody does.
Yes. And you'll be able, and the people who are listening right now, you'll be able to share those links with your friends.
Yes.
Please do.
Yes, I'm sure that a woman who listens to BAI at night knows exactly all about the archives and everything else. But
you're right.
I was letting other people know.
and I'm a Ken Gale fan.
Oh, thank you.
Take care. God, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Now our conversation has to live up to all the wonderful things you said.
Oh, my God.
It.
Yeah, right? How could she? If you want to join the conversation, 347-335-0818. We only have one line, so people can't call immediately. They have to know that that woman has hung up, and then they have to know that what the phone number is. So it takes a while for another call to get in if somebody else is trying to call right away.
Understood. Well, I'll continue talking about other things I published.
And somebody came in that quickly.
Okay, they stopped me from doing that. All right.
347-335-0818. You're on the air. Exactly. Yep, turn the radio down. You can hear it through your phone. Oh.
I guess we did. Okay, I also published You'll All Be Sorry, a collection of humorous essays by Gail Simone, a very popular comics writer. So this is a lot of her prose stuff. Published Crypto the Acid Dog, which is actors Bill Mooney and Miguel Ferrer co-writing a comic book drawn by the great Steve Lealoha.
Whoa.
They done a lot of short stories and a one-shot that appeared all over the place over the years. And so I just said, it should be one book. I mean, I love Steve Lealoha's work.
He's great.
So beautiful.
Yeah.
And Bill and Miguel, who unfortunately left us not that long, left us last year. But they had fun writing comics together.
Well, that's neat. Well, 347-335-0818. You're on the air.
Hello. I just wanted to say that Peanuts are very good for teaching little kids how to read because it's in all caps. And because, when little kids start to see those G's with a descender and the H and all that, the lowercase things, they're like, well, I'm never going to get this. But in all caps, they have a lot of. Mm-hmm. And then it's also written in the vernacular. So, it's not Dick and Jane at all.
Yeah, and also they can understand context from the facial expressions. When you're dealing with kids with peanuts, the facial expressions convey enough that it helps them understand what's going on, and I think that helps a lot.
Yeah, no, it's really wonderful. I tell that to everybody with little kids, you know, to go out and get some of those. Okay, that's it.
Oh, thank you.
All right, right. Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, and in when Calvin and Hobbes was coming out, it seemed fashionable for a lot of people to sort of say, well, in order to say how great Calvin and Hobbes was, they have to put down Peanuts. And so Bill Watterson came along and said, every single cartoonist drawing right now owes his livelihood to Charles Schulz and Peanuts. He has influenced every single person who does newspaper strips, including me. And he was clearly telling all those people, you know, if you're going to compliment me, you don't have to do it by putting down Charles Schulz.
Yeah, well, it's weird how people do that in a lot of fronts.
Yeah.
Schulz is the most powerful seed in American humor comic strips.
347? Yeah. Go ahead, finish your thought.
I was just about to say, one thing I didn't mention about what I do with Peanuts is I help put together books of lost Peanuts material in a couple cases. So if you got the complete Peanuts volume 26 that was filled with things that hadn't appeared in the daily strip but were Charles Schulz doing Peanuts, that is something that I helped put together. Yeah. Or the book Charlie Brown's Christmas Tales, which found some obscure Peanuts stories done for women's magazines. You know, I just love digging that stuff up. There's no reason any of it should be buried.
It's great that there are people like you exist who dig stuff like that up. 347-335-0818. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that it's so nice that you're doing this because me and my sister are so bored. And, yeah.
You have anything you want to say to Nat?
Go ahead.
What?
I'm not sure I heard you clearly. I apologize.
Oh, well, she was basically saying how much she's enjoying the show.
Oh, yes, well, then I'm... No wonder I didn't hear it. My ears don't hear compliments very well. but I thank you so much for that. Having great fun doing this show.
Well, do you have any questions you want to ask to Nat?
Not really.
Oh, okay. Well, that was neat.
That was wonderful.
Good night.
Good night.
Wow! If you're generating fans by this little overnight radio show, right? Here we are at 2:45 in the morning, and you're listening to Jim Freund's Hour of the Wolf. I'm Ken Gale, subbing for Jim. He'll be back next week. Jim normally brings science fiction writers reading and discussing their work. He brings some amazing writers. He's right on the cutting edge of science fiction. Amazing stuff. He brings live reading, so you can actually go and see the writers reading their work. The next one is this coming Tuesday. That's April 3rd at the Brooklyn Commons Cafe, 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, starting at 7 p.m. The readers are novelist Chandler Klang Smith and prose and comic book writer Chris Claremont. So all you X-Men fans, you want to hear Chris reading his prose work, come to 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. That's between Bond and Hoyt Streets. You can get here. It's the first or second stop in Brooklyn from Manhattan. You can get here by the 2345 to Nevin Street, the B, R, or Q to DeKalb, and the closest subway is the A, C, and G to Hoyt Schermerhorn. So that's this coming Tuesday at 7 p.m. And I should mention again the East Coast Comic Con, Friday to Sunday, April 27 to April 29 in Secaucus, New Jersey, 355 Plaza Drive in Secaucus, New Jersey. East Coast Comic Con is the comic book convention for the East Coast compared to what's at the Javits, which is like a car show that's more about movies than it is about comic books. So Anyway, so let's go to that, and you can tell Jim how much you miss him, and he'll be back next week. And so I'm Ken Gale. I'm talking to Nat Gertler, and his publishing company is aboutcomics.com. You'll see he's got a ton of stuff, not all of the comics, obviously. We wouldn't have been talking about the Green Book and Captain Billy's Whiz Bang if it was only comics.
Although I should have noted the Green Book actually does have a small comics connection, in that after Victor Green died, one of the editors on it, in at least some of the volumes, was a guy named Melvin Tapley, who was a comics guy for some New York papers, and also used to do, the most interesting thing that I found is a series of comic strip ads for Brown Bomber Bread. Brown Bomber was the nickname of a very popular fighter of the time, although they don't, as far as I know, they didn't actually license that name, they just used it. And they focused somewhat on the black community. It was black owned bread line, and he did ongoing strips where the day was always saved by somebody wanting black bomber bread. I would love to put out a collection of those someday.
Well, what is that, like the Hostess ads that comics were doing in the 70s?
It's somewhat similar to that, more of a four-panel version of that. I love the Hostess ads, and I've done several parodies of those in my work at various times. I love the day being saved by throwing Twinkies at the villain.
Yeah, I don't know if you ever saw the Fanzine Famous Funnies, or Fandom Funnies, but they did Hostess ads, satires in there. And just one of the day being saved by throwing broccoli spears at the villain.
Okay. That sounds much healthier.
Yes, it's healthier.
Throw your spears, broccoli spears if you got to be.
I mean, there are so many parodies of those silly Hostess ads.
Well, because the Hostess ads were A, fun, and B, one page. So you can do a quick one-page parody and get the whole thing in there.
And since they appeared in like every DC and Marvel comic, everybody was buying comics back then, or back issues of those comics, has seen those ads.
Yeah, and Harvey and Archie, they all had... They all have these ads. I would love to have a collection of all of these ads. I know there are people who put them online, but I like things in books. I like having them in my hand.
There is something special about books. And it was interesting, a few years ago, sales of books were going down and people were getting online books. Now sales of books are going up again. So clearly people do prefer having it in your hand rather than on a computer screen.
They found that reading a book is a very different experience digitally versus physically.
If your book collection is on a little computerized handheld device and you drop it in the water, you've lost your entire library. If you drop a book in the water, you've lost one book.
But in a lot of cases, if you have it like a Kindle, you're allowed to download it again. They've tracked your purchase. And I have made some of my books available in those formats because... Just because it's not my favorite format doesn't mean I'm not willing to take your money if it's your favorite format. But also, it's part of what I love is I love doing things where I don't have to worry about an inventory. So, print on demand, ebooks. I've done a couple audio books. I've produced audio book adaptations of the first of those Israel Bond Oi Oi 7 spy parodies, the first one was Locksfinger, did another parody co-written by the same guy called Jonathan Siegel Chicken. So those are both available as audiobooks.
They must have been a ball to read. I would imagine they do all kinds of accents in books like that.
Yeah, well, I had to find somebody who could handle the accents and the Yiddish humor. Sometimes I needed to coach very much somebody about what the Yiddish terms were and what they meant. I hope in the future to actually record some audiobooks myself using my own voice, and we'll see how that goes.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Minutes left. Lister is in the studio to do Burn Baby Burn. This has been a wonderful conversation with Nat Gertler of aboutcomics.com. And We've been talking about the Negro Motorist Green Book that came out from 1936 to 1967 so that black people could travel in their cars and find a place to eat and sleep. White people may not have thought about the fact that a book like that was so necessary and saved lives. And then we talked about Captain Billy's Whiz Bang, which was a book of humor that came out in the 20s by the guy who would later put out Captain Marvel. We talked about Diane Duane's graphic novel, The Misadventures of Prince Ivan, which originally appeared in The Dreamy from Eclipse Comics. Diane Duane is just such a wonderful author. I'm so glad that this is available. It's Diane's silly side that she didn't get to really just put out quite as much in when she was writing Star Trek. And we talked about Licensable Bear, which is Nat sort of making his comments about licensing and the way comics are thought about by the publishers these days, I think. And we talked about Charles Schulz's non-Peanuts work. And we talked about 24-hour comics day. So we covered a lot of ground. We went in a lot of different directions. You can see that people who are into comics are into a lot of other stuff as well, which is one of the reasons I was so happy to do this show, because it really gives the breadth of what people are into. So not every one of the things that Nat publishes is going to be for every single person listening, but I'll bet you there's something that Nat publishes that is for everybody who's listening.
Yeah, every once in a while I hear somebody say that they're an About Comics fan, and I get sort of confused by that, because we have such a broad array, and to the degree it gets a little tricky at conventions, because I've spent a convention across the way from the guy who does Too Much Coffee Man. If you walk by Too Much Coffee Man, you know instantly if you're at least interested, or if you need him to describe it, he can tell you in one sentence, two sentences,
right,
and either get you hooked or not. And you come by my table, I go, well, I got this thing over here, and this is a Jewish spy parody, and this is a famous science fiction author you like, and that he did a graphic novel, and here's a book of comic book scripts by different writers, famous writers, called Panel One. So you want to see how comic books are done, here's a bunch of different scripts. And I'm like all over the place. And here's a green book, and that has nothing to do with any of this stuff. And you should read it. It's very interesting. You should grab it and buy one of those. But it has nothing to do with all this stuff. So it takes me 5 minutes to explain my book to somebody. And I'm sort of
but you know what?
People who are a little more focused.
That's WBAI. WBAI has so many different kinds of programming. I'm interviewing you about comic books and other things, and I do an environmental show yesterday I was talking about NAFTA and what NAFTA is doing to our lives and what it will do more if the president has his way. But BAI has all these things. You can have music shows, you can have heavy politics, you can have authors, there's everything. So you're just doing the publishing print version of the kind of things that a BAI listener would have. So this is right up everybody's alley.
That makes sense.
And I'm going to go out with a song that I play a piece of on Ecologic by Sylvanus called Save the Earth. Reggae number to slide right into Lister's show. And so thank you, Nat, for being on BAI for 2 hours at night.
Thank you for the opportunity, and thank you to all the folks who took time to listen to me. As anybody who's listening who didn't listen, I'm mad at you. But the folks who are listening who did listen, thank you very much.
Okay. And if you came in the middle of this, you can hear all of it by going to WBAI.org in about 5 or 10 minutes. The whole show will be available for you to listen to. So a little bit of Sylvanus and then Lister. So there's no reason to, sorry for the person who's trying to go to sleep, but there's no reason to go to sleep. There's too much good stuff coming on BAI.
Dinner.
WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Coming up next are the wonderful music of Lister, so stay tuned.
When I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips, I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the bitch. The red part of the balloon spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk my people, the people all around the pigs lurk. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my writing is writing the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Wake up to the lies, the pigs make up imperialistic swines that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist, cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison, cause I'm messy attack. The flag, I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded, cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Some fire, my desire to burn. What Betty Ross Angola, up on my African Angola, call Angola, call Angola, call Angola, up on Shishamala Angola, call Angola. Me burn the fire from Babylon, not take no chat from Babylon. Cause a youth corrupt, you get a youth, we do no wicked duck, do no Babylon. When me walk, I trample down Babylon. Talk and ride down Babylon. Who no wild ways they have with your clans and plans, won't come trapping the man, who no think, who no can come take Mama Africa from me again. No, who no can come take Mama Africa from me again. Who no think, who no can come take Mama Africa from me again. No, who no can come take Mama Africa from me again. True religion, you bomb down a Lebanon. Lick yourself and a blame Afghanistan. We do no tricks and cons, implement a plan. Then you go dig down Saddam. We see you a draw nearer and nearer. But the Isle Mama got na go share ya. Oh, me nah get scared. We defend this prayer. Up a shasha malong girl. You no can come take Mama Africa from me again. You no think you no can come take Mama Africa from me again. No, you no can come take Mama Africa from me again. You no think you no can come take Mama Africa from me again. Them no like when we are in the hills. Them want we stay here fi pay them bills. When your things say you are safe, you are safe little cabbage. Them alone account of the mills. It's an authentic reggae beat. Let me skank off the shoes off of my feet. I get three Peter Touch, two Bob Marley, and the little berry sound sweet. You no can come take Mama Africa from me again. You no think you no can come take Mama Africa from me again. No, you no can come take Mama Africa from me again. You no think you no can come take Mama Africa from me again. So the bingy man a call Angola, call Angola, up on Mama Africa Angola, call Angola, call Angola, call Angola, up on Shashamala Angola, call Angola. Me burn the fire from Babylon, me a take the chat from Babylon.
My brother destroying our culture by killing one another away from the gates of Africa, giving way to the intruder. I said we should be in Angola. Oh yes, my brothers, now we should be in Angola. Oh yes, my sisters, do drive away the intruders, I say, from the land of our forefathers, I pray. Instead of fighting ourselves here, father, our work Indians, peace of square. Fighting here in Jamaica, it's a shame. My brother, yeah, destroying our culture by killing one another away from the gates of Africa, giving way to the intruder. I said we should be in Angola. Oh yes, my brothers, now we should be in Angola. Oh yes, my sisters, so get wise now, my brothers of black. It's not our brothers we should attack, no. Love and unity's our only keys to help destroy our enemies. So fighting here in Jamaica is a shame. My brother here, yeah, destroying our culture by killing one another here, yeah, away from the gates of Africa, giving way to the intruder. I said we should be in Angola. Oh yes, my brothers, now we should be in Angola. Oh yes, my city says to drive away the intruders. I said